This speaker that we have tonight, I know he has a good story, because I know that his sobriety speaks for him. So with that, I give you Russ.
My name is Russ. I'm an alcoholic. It's nice to be here tonight. I haven't been to this meeting in quite a while, and it's nice to see it still thriving. Let's get the qualifications out of the way. My sobriety date is April 5th, 1991. I have a home group, which is Sobriety First. We meet every Friday night at the Biscayne Room at 8 o'clock. It's an open discussion group. You are all most welcome. And I have a sponsor. I also sponsor people. I was told that a long time ago that if I'm going to manage to stay sober one day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to have those things in my program. And I didn't necessarily get them all at once. I didn't sponsor people for a while. I think my first time I sponsored somebody, I had about 2.5 years of sobriety. But I've always had a sponsor. To me, that's very important. Part of my story is that I had a lot of trouble growing up interacting with people. And for me to keep the lines of communication open, not only in the fellowship, and I need somebody I can call when I have to. I was born on August 7th, 1951. In Providence, Rhode Island, and I didn't stay there. My dad, back then the Korean War was going on, and my dad got called up to active duty. He was in the Air Force during World War II. So we kind of bounced around a little bit. I wasn't really firmly rooted for my first couple of years, and after that, when he finished college on the GI Bill, I like to call it a GE brat, because my dad got a job with General Electric as an engineer, and we went all over the place from Schenectady down to Cincinnati, and I lived in Louisville, Kentucky for a while, and then back up to the Northeast, and then over to New York State, and we eventually settled in a town a little north of Boston. I say all that to say this. My father flew 78 combat missions in World War II, and if you've been in the service, you know that's a pretty high number, because most people do 25 missions and they rotate out. But he did 78. He was in kind of a specialized aerial and reconnaissance unit. And when he got back, and he came back unscathed, which is a miracle in and of itself. But when he came back, he was on the GI Bill, put himself through college. So the guy had a pretty high opinion of himself when he got back. And what emerged later in my childhood, and after being here for quite a while, and learning some of the, I guess you call them backdrops of alcoholism, like some other things that outside issues that may be involved. My dad was not an alcoholic, but he did a really good imitation of a dry drunk for a lot of years, and he was also a narcissist. And what that meant for me is that he had absolute control over the way I responded emotionally to things. A very simple example is, if he found something funny and I didn't, laugh, I would get whacked, you know, because he would just keep telling me that, laugh at this, it's really funny. And so that brought on a lot of kind of like some childhood things that I didn't really understand until I came into AA. And I'm not saying that caused my alcoholism, because my whole family, I mean, if you look at my family tree on both sides, it's dotted with alcoholics. My grandfather was a bootlegger, and he ran a still out of his basement. He was not very successful at it, and I know this for two reasons. Number one, he drank up all his profits, right? So my grandmother and my mother and her siblings still lived kind of modestly to kind of like right over the poverty line, but I'm talking, you know, 1932, 1933, so they were all Depression-era kids. And the other reason I know that he was not a success at that business is I didn't get an inheritance. You know, kind of lost out on that. And back then it was a lead pipe cinch to make money on booze. But, you know, he drank all of it, and he drank a lot of it up, and he gave a lot of it away. He was always partying, and his idea of a gourmet meal was sitting on the doorstep of a closed mill with a bottle of his whiskey and eating half a blueberry pie. I mean, that was the best for him. You know, we talk a lot about being restless, irritable, and discontent, you know, I remember all that. I remember experiencing that at a very early age, and I remember the effect that alcohol had in kind of taking that edge off. You know, and it always seemed to work. I had my first drink when I was 4 years old, and my dad gave me a small 4 ounce glass of Schlitz beer, and I thought it tasted great. It was like really ice cold. If you know anything about Schlitz beer, it's like it's really kind of it's cheap. It's cheap beer, and it doesn't really taste that good. I thought it was terrific. And the reason I did is I kind of experienced that glow that we talk about once I had that first drink. So When there was an opportunity, even back then, I always made sure that I got some. And my dad actually was pretty accommodating for whatever reason. I never really asked him why, but he probably thought it would be a good way to get rid of me for a couple hours. Go out and play with my friends and all that and stay out of his hair. Anyway, life kind of went on. Okay, and it wasn't, you know, externally, we and you hear this a lot in AA, because my dad was an engineer, he did fairly well economically. It was a decent job, you know, from the outside, it was kind of like that Ozzy and Harriet type period in American history or whatever. It was the 1950s and the 1960s, and, you know, Donna Reed Show and all that stuff was kind of promoting, you know, that kind of image. And on the outside, we were like that. On the inside, it was something entirely different. My parents, very early on in their marriage, did not get along, but my mother thought it was necessary to stay for them to stay together for the sake of me and my brother, you know, to kind of hold the family together. And I don't know, that was their decision, and I do know that I kind of stayed out of everybody's way once I had the opportunity to kind of, you know, go off with my friends a little bit. And, you know, the after school stuff kind of turned into coming home for supper and then going back out again, and every once in a while I'd get some failing grades that were brought to my attention, and I mean, we really didn't do anything wrong. We were not juvenile delinquents, maybe in kind of like a Little Rascal sense, if anybody remembers the Little Rascals, you know, just getting into that kind of trouble, but in terms of vandalism and all that stuff, no. anyway, life, as I said, life kind of went on, and we actually moved 1, 2, 3 times when I was a teenager. So I went to 3 different high schools as well. And I ended up in, we ended up in a town outside of Providence, Rhode Island, on the Massachusetts side. Things, you know, things are kind of progressing, and, you know, I got to back up just one click, because I forgot to mention something. I mentioned 3 high schools. The second high school was in upstate New York, right outside of Rochester. And I had never really gotten into trouble with alcohol before. I mean, I would kind of dabble in it, but I was always kind of drawn towards it. You know, I just kind of felt the pull. It's a term that I heard at an AA meeting once. Anyway, this one particular night, the drinking age in New York State was 18, so it was really easy back then. So it was really easy for people to. Kids from high school who were 16, who maybe looked 20, to go in and just buy as much as they could, because the IG laws were kind of very relaxed back then too. I get completely ossified that night for whatever. I just couldn't stop. I mean, it was Budweiser, and we had like 2 24 packs, and I was just pounding them down. And, you know, I'm not physically imposing, so it really doesn't take a whole lot of alcohol for me to, you know, start changing. My friends really didn't know what to do with me by the end of this little drinking bout, so they just kind of left me on my front yard. Somewhere along the line, this was in the spring, I lost my shirt, so I was apparently sitting on my front yard, very drunk without a shirt, I could feel my pants getting wet, because my dad had just reseeded the front lawn, and it was soaked from a watering he did. I got up, and I walked to the front porch. I rang the doorbell, because the door was locked. And my parents opened the door, and they were just completely horrified at what they saw. I mean, I was, you know, bloodshot eyes, I was slurring my speech, I didn't look good. And they asked me if I had been drinking. And I said, no. Right? And my father said, I'm going to ask you again, were you drinking? And I said, no. And I turned around and I threw up all over the front porch. I said, I'm just sick. I'm going to go to bed. So I went upstairs and I slept it off. That was really the end of it for that night. I came back down the next day, and my mom was making eggs, which really didn't look real good to me at that point. She said, your father wants to talk to you. And he's outside watering the lawn. So I went outside, and he said, were you drinking last night? I said, no. Very casually, no, I wasn't drinking. Now, I was a little snarky, but he said, okay, I'm going to ask you one more time. Were you drinking? And I said, I'm going to tell you one more time. No. And I turned around. And I stormed off, and I went back into the house. I went back up to my room and turned some music on. And I just got pissed. And the reason I got pissed is he didn't believe my lie. Right? And as far as I can tell, that's my first alcoholic resentment. Because I carried that thing from the drinking party was Saturday, that was Sunday. The entire week I was just stewing over this thing. And it was like interfering with like my schoolwork. I was trying to write a paper or take a quiz or something like that, and halfway through the quiz, I'm just thinking about this. It eventually diminished and kind of went into my memory banks until I came in here, because I really didn't think about it for quite a while after. After that happened, I came up in the 1960s, and I used a lot of supplements, as I call them. But one of the things that emerged is, at least in my story when I sat down and thought about it, is that alcohol was always around. You know, it was either the hors d'oeuvre, or it was the main course, or it was a dessert, or it was a gravy I poured over everything. You know, it was kind of like the foundation for whatever activity was going on. You know, I had a couple of more, I guess you'd call them signposts, looking back on it now. In high school, we used to have these drinking parties, and we'd get a 55-gallon drum, fill it up with ice and a lot of beer, and just start drinking. But one of the things that I remember about some of those parties anyway is that I was always the one who didn't deviate too far from the 55-gallon drum. You know, because I wanted to make sure I always got mine. You know, people would ask me I was a senior in high school. People would ask me if they thought I was drinking too much. I said, no, I'm just partying, you know, having a good time. But that was always the trajectory. And I didn't really understand why I was drinking the way I was drinking when I drank back then, because I was still at that point in my career, drinking career, so to speak, where alcohol really wasn't doing anything to me yet. It was still doing a lot of things for me. And one of the things was it made me 10 feet tall and bulletproof, you know. Life just kind of went on, and the drinking and the supplements started happening a little more frequently. I remember in college, my first day of college, I blacked out at a party, and I woke up. I was actually at a bar. Again, this is in New York State, so I'm 18, and you know, I thought it was great. I had a student deferment. I was not going to get drafted, and I thought I had really made it, you know. And I ended up shit-faced in this bar, and I fell down. I was drinking Budweiser and peppermint schnapps, like one after the other, you know. And I fell down, and I was kind of wedged between the side of the bar and a cigarette machine, and nobody knew what to do with me, so they just kind of left me there. Until the end of the evening, they picked me up, and they brought me back to my room, and I woke up in my own vomit, and my roommate was like 10 or 15 feet away in his bed, and, you know, that that relationship didn't last too long, because I immediately went to, you know, I sought out the people who partied and drank and drugged like I did, and he just did something else. So that was my whole career in school was kind of marked by that. I always went to the parties. I went to a lot of really good concerts back then, and the problem is a lot of those really good concerts back then, I can't remember a lot of them, you know. And these are like, you know, classic rock bands. Well, they became classic rock bands in the 70s, but, you know, back then when they were coming up, it was something a little bit different. You know, I'd squander stuff. I'd drink a lot, and I would kind of get overpowered, is the best way to put it, by a lot of this stuff. I didn't see it as a problem. I didn't know it was a problem. I thought everybody was acting the way I was acting, and that really wasn't the case. It just sort of became, you know, that was the norm for me for quite a while. I did get through school, and I just kind of eked by. Then I thought it would be a really good idea to go to another school, because I thought so much of my academic grades and career that I was going to go get a master's degree. within about 6 weeks, the school I was in didn't really have the same opinion, and they asked me to withdraw. So that was another excuse, and it was during that period that I started discovering the morning drink. Right. And that, I didn't do that all the time, but I knew it was available, and there were a lot of days when I needed it. So I left school and got a job in a factory. I put heads on G.I. Joes at the Hasbro Toy Company for about a year. I was a real just kind of working class guy, but back then there were factories like that and all over the place. So I did that, and then I got a job in my uncle's factory, and he made jewelry. He told me he was going to pay me a little more money, which he did. But after that, I never got a raise. And this job involved pouring molten metal into a mold that kind of spun around. It was called a centrifugal force mold, and it had these little pieces of costume jewelry in it. So I did that for a while. And while all this was going on, I'm being introduced to the bar life. More than I had done before, and I thought that was great. I'd always loved the action in the bar rooms, and people kind of picking each other's pocket and including mine. But I hung out with these guys who taught me some survival skills in a few of these bars that I drank at, and that worked out pretty good for a while, but I was running up some bills and running up these bar tabs that I knew I couldn't pay. So at one point, I just kind of left abruptly, and I moved to another town. It's called the North Shore of Boston, and the first town I moved to was Salem, and then Beverly, which is the town north of there. So I was trying to reestablish myself there and thinking to myself, okay, this is going to be a lot different. I'm going to do things right. I got a better job, more respectability. And after a while, that didn't work out either. And the job involved me being on the road, and I would go to these, accident sites where people got hurt in like car wrecks or, building collapses and all that stuff. And I would photograph the sites, and if I could, I would make maps of what happened. That went on for a while, but as all of that was going on, I was drinking more because this was like an alcoholic's dream, right? I'm on the road. I could stop off at any point and have a couple of bops. Anyway, I had that job for a while. It got to the point where I was just... I was really getting more arrogant, somehow they describe it, towards people in at work, and then towards people on the outside, my barroom buddies, so to speak. There were some harsh words, and there was not physical fights, but a lot of screaming sometimes, and my boss eventually couldn't put up with it, and I got walked out. And that really, during that period of my life, which was in my 20s and in my 30s, I went through a few jobs where I kept telling myself things are going to be different, I'm going to tone it down, and that never happened, and these people they're not going to survive without me. That was one of the buzzwords that I used with some of my bosses when I was being walked out or fired. You're going to go down, you need me. I remember the last time that happened, before I got in here, I was being walked out by a security guard, and I was telling him this. the company's not going to survive without me. And that was like, he could have cared less. He just wanted to get me and my car off the property, you know. It was a few years before that that I met somebody in a bar, and she was from Laredo, Texas. And she could drink me under the table. So I was automatically in love. She was a big drinker. She was a power drinker. She was also an alcoholic. I didn't know that. And in fact, she got sober 2 years before I did. But we decided it would be a good idea to get married, and which we did. We eloped and set up this little house in an apartment up there, and for a while it was okay. You know, we found this one bar that we really liked, so we always went there, and the marriage never really got violent, but we would have these screaming matches, and she had quite a temper, and I could get pretty pissed off myself when things were right and I had a few drinks in me, but this kind of went on. It was kind of an alcoholic marriage that went on for a few years. We bought a house in this town way out in the country, this small town on the New Hampshire border, and that's where things really started to spin out. I mean, we were financially falling apart, and as I said earlier, I was losing jobs, and I really didn't have anything to fall back on except alcohol. And the town we lived in had a lot of bars. There were four bars that were in walking distance of the house, and two liquor stores. So I was thrilled over that because I didn't have to drive anywhere to get any alcohol. And that's really the way it was. It was for me, that was my little contained community. And there was some stuff that went on, and she eventually left. But a couple of things happened. The day before she left, I was out drinking and drugging, and I don't remember what time I got back to the house, but I didn't go in. And there was a small hedgerow in front of the house, and it was probably about 3 feet from the sidewalk. So the house was fairly close to the sidewalk. There was a small space, which was our front yard, maybe 2 or 3 feet, and then it was a hedgerow. Well, apparently at some point, I ended up in that little space of yard. I passed out, and the hedgerow was maybe like this, and my leg was sticking out of the bushes right into the sidewalk, right? So if you're walking down the street, and a few people did because they were walking to work, all I would see was coming up the street was this leg sticking out of the bushes. And my wife eventually got up and I wouldn't exactly call it frothy emotional appeal, but, you know, she was on the second floor kind of screaming at me to get up. And stuff like that went on all the while, or at least towards the end there, it went on a lot. And I got up, and I was wearing like dark pants, like dark chinos, and I had a dark shirt on, and I went in to get a swallow of coffee because I knew I had to go to work and I was already late. And she's kind of saying that, you know, you're going to lose this one too, talking about the job. And I just kind of looked at her, and then I went into the bathroom, looked in the mirror, and said, you know, I really don't look that bad. So I just kind of watered. Back then I had a lot of hair, so I kind of watered my hair down, and I brushed my clothes off with a brush, and I just went to work. And I stunk of booze, and my boss let me sit over in the corner that day. I didn't do much of anything. But he eventually got tired of some of the shenanigans I was pulling, which is basically just showing up late or not showing up, you know. And I figured I would use my vacation time, right, for all this stuff. Well, I was well past that, this last job, and I got let go. It was about this time that my wife discovered AA, and she got sober a couple of years before I did. She came in one day and said, there's a new rule in this house. And I said, well, what's that? She said, I don't live here anymore. So she took off her wedding ring and threw it at me. It kind of bounced off my head. And I'm not thinking about, honey, come back, I need you. My first thought when that happened was, you know, I could get a lot of drinks out of this event. You know, and that's exactly what happened. I went down to the bar, played victim. My wife left me. What am I going to do? Here, have another one. And then eventually, everybody got wise to that. And they said, no, we're not doing that anymore. You've got to cut off. But I got a few minutes left to tell you what happened. I cracked up on a bar stool one night. I mean, this whole cycle of, bad relationships and losing jobs and I could never see my part in it. And page 62 talks a lot about my part. I never saw any of that because it was kind of like Teflon. I could always justify and rationalize it. I could always justify and rationalize the next first drink. This went on for a long time. But one day or one night, I was sitting at a bar stool nursing a gin and tonic, and I cracked up. I said, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do this anymore. And this, I gave you kind of a condensed version, but this went on for like 20 years. I didn't know what I was going to do. For the first time in my life, I left a drink on the bar because I got up and I started to walk out. And I left all my money on the bar, which wasn't much. It was probably somebody else's money anyway, because I used to like slide somebody else's tip money over to keep my tab going. But the reality was that I was spent, and I knew I was spent. Because a few years before that, I was sitting at the bar, and I knew, I had that little moment of clarity about 4 or 5 years before I came into AA, that alcohol had me. I knew it had me, but I didn't want to do anything about it. So I just kept justifying and rationalizing the next drink, and that went on for a while. But this particular day, honestly, it wasn't a jackpot. Nothing unusual was happening. I just, as I said, I just cracked up. I walked out of the bar. I walked up the street wondering what I was going to do, because I knew that finally, and I admitted to myself that there was some connection between my drinking and all these calamities and disasters that had gone on for so many years. I made the connection. And as I was thinking about that, two guys were coming down the street who I hadn't seen in a while. I used to shoot darts with them and party with them about 3 or 4 years before that, maybe 5 years. And they said, how you doing? And we talked for a little bit. And they said, well, what's going on with you? You don't look good. And I looked at one of the guys. I said, I need help. And that was the first honest utterance that I had ever about needing help and realizing that I didn't know what an alcoholic was, but I knew that alcohol was central to everything that was going on. We talk a lot about God's timing in AA. I found out very shortly after that admission by me that these guys had been clean and sober in AA. And they were just out walking. And I had walked no more than, as I said, 50 feet when I ran into them. I would have told you, in fact, when I was in AA, I would have told you, in early AA, I would have told you that that was like the biggest coincidence that ever happened in my life. Right? I knew nothing about God. I was a practicing atheist. I had no use for religion. So anyway, to get back to that story. They said, well, maybe we can sit and talk. Maybe we can help you with this. And we went back to my house, which, by the way, I was getting kicked out of because I got a foreclosure notice. But that was the financial mismanagement and all the stuff we had done. They stayed with me for 3 days. They 12-stepped me in AA. And what they did is they shared their experience with what happened to them when they picked up the first drink. It was very simple. But it took me a little bit of time to kind of grasp that. And the thing that amazed me is, these guys look nothing like the people who I met or who I knew back then. I mean, they looked very healthy, looked like they'd been working out they were changed. They weren't into that drunken stupor that we all used to get into at the bar. And they fed me a lot of orange juice and honey. And I didn't know what the reason for that was until later, about just trying to normalize. But they stayed with me. And they talk, and when I wanted to sleep, I don't know what they did. I know one of them was watching TV, when I woke up, they would just kind of ease back into it again. But it was really, really some very basic first step stuff. And then they went on a little bit and shared what happened to them once they got into the process. And started taking the steps. And I didn't know too much about that, but what I did realize after those 3 days is that I really needed a way out, because what I was doing, I couldn't do it anymore. I just couldn't. So with that, I asked them, how can this happen? How can I get, I don't remember what the exact words were, but I asked them basically how I could kind of take part in this. And before I knew what was going on, I was in the back seat of you remember those old Chrysler station wagons from the 80s? You had like that, the tan and the fake wood siding. That's what I was brought to my first AA meeting in. They brought me to the basement of a Baptist church, and they said, what you needed in there? And they said, just go down to the end of the hall, and there are some people in there just like us, and just tell them you're new. So I did that. They did not get out of the car. I was the car was probably about here to where that door is back there, and they were watching me, but they wanted to see if I was going to go into the church or bolt, And I went in. And I sat down. I identified myself as being new. And one of the things that happened just before the meeting started, as I was sitting down, as I flopped into a seat, I had this thought that I knew I belonged there. I didn't know why, but I knew I belonged there. And that's, that's how it started. And that group became my first home group. because that beginner's meeting was part of a larger group that met upstairs after the beginner's meeting. So I went to the beginner's meeting, and then I went to the speaker meeting that is kind of like this. Maybe it was a little bigger. I met some people there my first night, and I was given some phone numbers, but I was told to get more. Get as many as you could. And what was interesting is I found those old pieces of paper. When I moved in, I moved to Atlanta about 20 years ago. But I found all those pieces of paper, and a lot of the people gave me the numbers are gone. But a lot of them are still around because my brother still lives up in New Hampshire, and there's a clubhouse like this that I go to. And I often see them when I'm there. What that beginners meeting talked about, what they talked about at least back then, is they talked about the 12 steps, but they said there were four really big ideas behind these steps. The first is surrender. The second one is sharing. The third one is restitution. And the fourth one is seeking guidance. Once I was well enough and I was able to get into the steps a little bit, I had already lived that first part of the first step. You know, I knew from my own experience that I was powerless. What I was having trouble with is I was sitting in the middle of this unmanageability that I really had a lot of trouble with and didn't really understand it. And a lot of it was external stuff, like finances and all that. The beauty of this program is that there's somebody who's already experienced or has already gone through what you are experiencing in early sobriety, and there are a lot of people who helped me, and all those things that are talked about on page 52. Some people call it the bedevilments, but it's you know, having trouble or keeping a job down, having trouble with your relationships, your financials, and all that. The program has offered me a way out on that stuff. But I had to get into, there were two things I had to do, really. I had to get over this atheistic concept that I had, that there was no God. And, you know, I would get really defiant about that. The two main characteristics of my alcoholism are dishonesty and defiance. And every once in a while, this defiance would rear its ugly head when I was talking to old-timers and all that, and the guy who eventually became my sponsor. And I would kind of bristle with a lot of antagonism sometimes and just argue. Their general response was a smile, and they just told me to keep coming back. But I had been to enough meetings, and I had that phrase out of the third step prayer that says, relieve me of the bondage of self. Nothing else, just relieve me of the bondage of self. We don't care if you believe in God or not, just say that. Right? So I did. And it was right after that. I walk into a discussion meeting, and they're talking about God. And I was like, well, here we go again. You know. And I'm, you know, my back's kind of getting stiff, and I'm ready to say something stupid. And I didn't say anything. I just kept quiet. And I walked outside. I was in the parking lot. I looked up at the sky, and I flipped off God. I said, F you, God. You know, I was really angry. And the guy who eventually became my sponsor just kind of tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know, you realize, of course, you've just acknowledge the existence of something you've been in denial about for a while. He just turned around and walked away. And I had to, you know, that gave me pause. Because there is a way, and Bill talks about this later, about how you can work this program early on if you're an atheist. And it didn't really involve God or prayer or anything like that. But it always involved taking action. And I always had service positions. I still have service positions today. I think that's very important for me. It keeps me centered. I have that home group, I work with people. Keeping the lines of communication open is something that I have to do. Because I can very, one of the things I noticed about myself, I can very easily recoil into that, kind of like self-containment or being self-absorbed. And that's just, that's just the way it is. It's part of my makeup. But as I said, I have a way out, and it's in the steps. There are things I can do. You know, I've already accepted this and acknowledged this about myself. I'm going to share like two more things, and then I'll. My sponsor, my first sponsor, who brought me up to the fifth step. I took my first fifth step with him, and I just felt so different. You know, I couldn't really articulate what I was feeling, but I just felt so different. Like I had this enormous burden lifted off of my shoulder. After I, that afternoon, he said, okay, now read about step 6 and 7 in the book, and we'll talk about it. He went out. He went out that next day. So that kind of put me in a situation. You know, once again, the hand of AA was there for me. And I was able to, very soon after that happened, I was able to continue taking the rest of the steps. But it's action. You know, for me, it's always been action. Dr. Bob's prescription, so to speak, for treatment was clean house, help others, trust God. And I try to do that every day. You know, some days better than others. But the result was, and the result of me eventually being willing to take all the steps as they are written has led to the time I have, the life I have today. I became a grandfather last year. That was a big thing for a guy who didn't think he was going to get married, and then when he thought he was going to get married, I was going to get married, pull a Dennis Hopper, and get married at 56, and then have my first kid at 57. But you know, God had other plans. I met somebody, and I know a lot of you know her, who had 3 kids. So I became a stepfather before I became a grandfather, and that's just one of the many things that happened to me in AA that you can't put a price tag on. You absolutely can't. And that's what I think this program is all about. Thank you.
Thank you.
You took a rolling stop through the old playground. It ain't what you thought, but look at what you found. The beautiful thing that you love so hard. Just an old newspaper blowing across the yard. There's a raveling thread in the old rag top. Board in the window where you used to shop. Pull a cracked up smile from a pissed off wind. You put your foot through the door when you can't come in. Empty glass, shady past, you'll find sometime. It is strange how you've changed. Nobody's problem now. Nobody's problem now. Well, the angel's arms are full of holes. off outside where it's nice and cool. There's a sad soul song that you used to share. There's a vacant space where you used to care. You're a spark in the dark. Hey, you burn somehow. On your way, like they say. You're nobody's problem now. You're nobody's problem. Sun comes up, we'll still be here. When we've had enough, we'll still be here. When the flame is gone, we'll still be here. When it all comes home, we'll still be here. There's weeds in the walk where the home place leans. Cattails crying in a dried up stream. You take a long deep breath and blow it out slow. You bring the same old shadow everywhere you go. You're a spark in the dark. Hey, you burn somehow. Ain't it strange how you've changed? You're nobody's problem now. You're nobody's problem now. You're nobody's problem now. You're nobody's problem.